This is Northeast School Corporation and Mr. Condris.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Condris. I represent the appellant Stephen Halfhill, who is the plaintiff below in his case against the Northeast School Corporation. He has requested the reversal of an adverse summary judgment ruling. His claims are broken. He broke his claims into two different categories. The first involved Indiana law claims based upon a breach of contract. The second category involved federal law claims for violations of his procedural due process rights, that claim brought under Section 1983. Because the Section 1983 claims are based upon a property right in that case, I believe it's appropriate to address his breach of contract claims first, showing that a contract did exist, creating this right. In summary judgment motions, and there were cross motions filed by both sides, the Northeast School Corporation argued, and the district court accepted, that Mr. Halfhill's contract, which incorporated a collectively bargained master contract, was silent on the issue of the contract's renewal into further years. One basis for this appeal is that claim is not true. In his summary judgment briefing, Mr. Halfhill had designated Article 13, Section D of that master contract, which also incorporated Appendix C, which was a form that included information that was to be provided to the teachers in Section 5 regarding recommendations about the contract's renewal, the contract's non-renewal, permanency status, or reassignment to a different position. This Article 13D section was specific to non-permanent teachers, and that included Mr. Halfhill. They were to be given this information regarding whether or not they'd been recommended for renewal of a contract or non-renewal of a contract by January 1st of each year. The Indiana statute, which has been relied more upon by Northeast School Corporation in its briefings, required information about contract non-renewal to be provided to non-permanent teachers by May 1st of each year. As that Article 13D reads, as part of an evaluation process that the school corporation in the contract called growth and improvement, the teacher had a right to an evaluation, the right to a conference if an evaluation included any negative information or any information with which the teacher was displeased. The teacher had a right to a conference, the right to rebut any evaluation in writing, and the right to attempt to make improvements in order to change the evaluator's mind, particularly if it related to a recommendation such as contract non-renewal. Very importantly,
did Mr. Baker have the authority to bind the board?
I think that the board had the authority to create a contract greater than the statute provided, and I think that it delegated the authority. Actually, Article 13D designates either the principal or the school administrators to provide this information in the evaluation, which included the form that talked about contract renewal or non-renewal. So whether that is considered to be actual authority, which I believe it is, or at least from the teacher's standpoint to constitute some apparent authority, yes, I believe that he was able to bind or to create that expectation, I should say.
Has Mr. Halfhill ever offered anything in the way of evidence to indicate Mr. Baker made the promise to him?
He has designated the evaluation form itself and the two evaluations before it. There had been recommendations for contract renewal, and the two before, the contract had been renewed. In terms of certain portions of that master contract which were incorporated into Mr. Halfhill's contract, there were certain provisions that were greater than Indiana's statutes governing teacher employment required. This included Article 13D, also the Article 14 rights, which are basically a progressive discipline system. If a teacher has a problem or any deficiency which may lead to a dismissal, and also Article 5, Section G, which was a very broadly worded just cause provision. It required for any employee, which included non-permanent teachers, that there be just cause if that...
So is your argument that a teacher obtains tenure from the first day on the job?
I think that the way that this contract was worded, that interpretation is viable.
Yeah, but that's ridiculous.
But...
That's absurd, right? No one grants tenure to a, 22-year-old teacher on his first day.
That may be true, but there were also arguments made at the summary judgment stage and again in the brief regarding the party's freedom to contract. The party's freedom, it was even addressed in Article 2.
But why would a school board ever grant tenure to someone on his first day of work?
I do not know.
Well, aren't contracts supposed to be interpreted so that they make some minimal sense?
Yes, I think that.
So your interpretation doesn't make minimal sense.
I think that it does, but I think
no, it doesn't, because it doesn't make sense to give a young employee tenure his first day on the job.
This just cause provision provided protections not just from discharge, but also that if any action taken that constituted discipline or a deprivation of a professional advantage also be done with some just cause. The facts that both sides relied upon in their summary judgment motions were not in any great
dispute. So you're clinging to your argument that the teacher gets tenure from the first day of employment?
I think that the teacher has a right under this contract as it reads within the four corners, and if it is read in harmony, all the provisions with one another, that a teacher has a right not to have an adverse
That's
job
called
action.
Tenure.
It could be interpreted that
what
way,
do you mean
yes.
It could be interpreted. What's the alternative interpretation?
That he had a right to have some entitlement to the job.
You described it as a just cause provision. That's tenure.
We did interpret it that way, Judge. Separate from that issue, however, the court had a one-paragraph discussion of all of Mr. Hafhill's breach of contract claims. They included a claim that if he was going to have his contract not renewed, he had a right to have that information by January 1st. There's no dispute that that did not happen, that he also had rights at a minimum to try to keep his job, to get that information early and try to correct whatever deficiencies the school was claiming that he had. And as a final fallback, with this early warning, if nothing else, he would be able to preserve his career because he'd have early warning, be able to go out into the job market knowing by January 1st instead of May 1st that he very likely could lose his job. I think that this comes back, and that could be read in harmony with Article 5, Section G. It is a professional advantage. It is one conferred upon him by this contract. He is going to get this early warning so that he can protect his job for future years. Article 13D talks about more than protection of just his job during that one school year. His last contract was 2002-2003. It talks about future years with contract renewal. I think it at least was a professional advantage to have that information. He had asked for summary judgment in his favor on that breach of contract argument because there's no dispute that he was not given warning that what the school calls incidents during these proceedings were not told to him through Article 14, any of the disciplinary system, or in any of his evaluations. He had asked for breach of contract on that basis. If the contract, he had also made the argument that if the contract could not be interpreted strictly that he had an expectation of continued employment just upon the language in the contracts, he had made an argument about mutually explicit understandings. That argument was not addressed by the district court in its ruling. Mr. Hafhill wanted summary judgment in his favor on that issue, but at the very least would argue that there is a fact dispute that a reasonable juror could determine that based upon the language which tells a teacher, as part of your evaluation, we're going to tell you by January 1st if your contract's going to be renewed, by the fact that Mr. Hafhill did designate that in November of 2002, during that 02-03 school year, he was told that his contract was going to be renewed. And then finally, the history of the school corporation, we had asked the superintendent, had there ever been a non-permanent teacher whose employment was terminated in a circumstance other than a layoff or for just cause, and his answer was no, not that I can think of. So based upon that information, we believe that a legitimate expectation was created for Mr. Halfhill that he was going to continue in his employment at least the next year, and that this mutually explicit understanding can at least serve as the basis for his property interest claim related to his procedural due process arguments. The Section 1983 claims, we had made claims based upon his pre-termination procedure and his post-termination procedure. The pre-termination procedure, we are not arguing that the process itself was unfair or problematic. We're arguing that as it was applied to Mr. Halfhill, it was unfair. There had been some inconsistencies. At some points, both sides had claimed that the superintendent and principal could speak on behalf of the school board, and at some points not. But there had been an argument by Northeast that the meeting on April 22nd between the principal and superintendent telling Mr. Halfhill they were going to go to the board and recommend he be terminated constitutes a sufficient pre-termination meeting where he had notice and an opportunity to respond because he spoke to them at that meeting. But it was clear from Northeast's facts that it presented that the principal and superintendent said they were going to make a recommendation. They did not say that they were part of the decision-making body. There was an actual special meeting called on April 28th only to talk about Mr. Halfhill's termination of employment. Notice was given to the principal and superintendent. Notice was given to the local newspaper, but Mr. Halfhill was not invited. He was not given an opportunity to respond. And from a fundamental fairness standpoint, we would argue that if the school corporation chooses this process, pre-termination process, chooses to have some sort of hearing, that it should at least invite the other side, give him an opportunity to hear what is being claimed about him, and give him an opportunity to present his side of the story. The decision not to renew his contract was made that night, and it was communicated to Mr. Halfhill the next day. On appeal, the school corporation has also claimed that he had an opportunity on May 22nd to finally have a meeting before the board, and that was part of the pre-termination rather than post-termination process, but the decision had been made. I do not believe that that is correct, but regardless, Mr. Halfhill presented his evidence that he was told at the beginning it was not a hearing. He was not able to present his documents or his evidence at that meeting, and believe that that, if nothing else, was a futile process, but that would be a different argument. And on summary judgment, they had argued about the April 22nd meeting. The post-termination arguments that Mr. Halfhill made regarded the fact that we had evidence from the superintendent telling him that he could, if he went through the arbitration process, which was part, again, the process was fine. But as it was applied to him, he was told that the process was a waste of time. He was told that the people that had already made the decision, regardless of the outcome of the arbitration, are going to be the people that decide that as well. We believe that we did not ask for summary judgment on that issue, but believe that the facts were such that a reasonable juror could have ruled that that was futile or a sham. I notice that the white light is on, and I have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, judges.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gondres. Mr. Semler?
May it please the court. My name is Ron Semler. I'm here on behalf of Northeast School Corporation. The questions of contract breaches and property interest are very much interwoven, and consequently I would like to address it from the aspect of property interest because that was formed the basis of the jurisdiction of the district court. What we have is a situation where Mr. Halfhill worked for Northeast School Corporation for 2 years under 2 one-year contracts and did not receive a third one-year contract. He is alleging that not receiving the third one-year contract is a breach of or is a deprivation of property interest without due process. The first question that the district court addressed was, did Mr. Halfhill have a property interest in receiving that third contract? In order to answer that question, I think one has to understand the statutory scheme in Indiana for the tenure of teachers. Like most states, it is governed by statute. In Indiana, you have three categories of teachers: a permanent teacher who has had five individual contracts, a semi-permanent teacher who has entered into his third one-year contract, and both the permanent and semi-permanent teachers have what is considered under statute as a continuing contract until it's canceled under certain procedures on certain grounds. And then you have non-permanent teachers. A person is a non-permanent teacher until they enter into their third one-year contract. Under the statute pertaining to non-permanent teachers, the school board is required to give the teacher notice by May 1 of the school year as to whether or not that contract will be renewed. A non-renewal decision not to renew a contract can be based upon anything which the school board determines to be in the interest of the school corporation. If that notice is given, then the teacher has the right to request reasons in writing for the non-renewal of the contract, and the teacher also has the right to request a meeting with the school board to...
What if the reason given was we don't like you?
If that's in the interest of the school board, I think that that is good enough.
It's good enough.
Right. He has the right to request to meet with the school board and explain to the school board why the decision should be reversed. If he requests such a meeting, then the school board has to take a vote within 10 days to either affirm or reverse their original decision. That's the statutory scheme we're dealing with. And so the district court looked at that statutory scheme and looked at the collective bargaining agreement to see whether or not any provision of the collective bargaining agreement basically changed that statutory scheme. It found that it did not. Therefore, it found no property interest in that third one-year contract. Mr. Halfhill does not necessarily base his claim of a property interest on the statute. He does base it on that collective bargaining agreement. One provision that he cites is the just cause provision that he referred to. As pointed out in our briefs, especially in the area of education law, a distinction is drawn between discharge, dismissals, and non-renewal of contracts. Discharge, dismissal deal with the current relationship between the parties. Non-renewal deals with the future relationship between the parties. The district court looked at Article 5, subsection G, and noted that even though the school and the teachers union could change the provisions of the statutory scheme, there was nothing specifically in that provision which indicated that they chose to do so. The court noted that there are no terms such as non-renewal, denial of extension, or things like that included in that provision. Consequently, it found that from looking at the contract itself, it could not determine that the parties had intended to change the statutory scheme. The question of renewal of a contract is basically not addressed in that provision. Mr. Halfhill also seems to argue that not renewing his contract is discipline of some sort. Again, Mr. Halfhill had a contract for the school year 2002-2003 that was completed by the parties. He taught the entire school year. He was paid for the entire school year. He was not suspended. He was not fined. He received no extra assignments. He was not told to go teach in a closet somewhere. Basically, he is arguing that discipline was imposed in not renewing his contract. But again, that is a totally discretionary benefit that the school board could bestow, which really had nothing to do with the current school contract. It could be withheld for financial reasons, it could be withheld for philosophical reasons, or it could be withheld just because the school board did not want to assume the risk. We have an individual here who, over a two-year period, has had four complaints of inappropriate physical contact with students. The school board is clearly on notice if another instance arises that there may be a problem here, and the school board basically may not wish to take that risk. We would submit that that is in no way, shape, or form discipline under the contract. The dismissal procedure is another basis that Mr. Halfhill advanced as far as a basis for a property interest. Again, we would remind the court that procedures themselves do not create property interest, and the failure to renew Mr. Halfhill's contract is no more a dismissal than it was a discharge. In the briefing in this court, the primary contention seems to evolve around Section or Article 13 of the contract dealing with evaluations. Again, evaluations has its basis in statute. Indiana Code, at the time, Indiana Code 20-6.1-4-14B2, found on page 19 of our appendix, stated that a teacher had a right to an annual evaluation before January 1 of every year. A non-permanent teacher had a right to an additional evaluation if he so requested. There's nothing in the statute that indicates that a favorable evaluation or an unfavorable evaluation is any way binding on the decision to either renew or not renew the contract. Article 13 fleshes out the procedure to be used for such evaluations. But again, if the court looks at Article 13, nothing in Article 13 indicates that a favorable or unfavorable evaluation is any way binding on a renewal decision. Instead, Mr. Halfhill relies solely on an evaluation form, part of which form includes the section entitled Recommendations. The person who is doing the evaluation can check one of four boxes: recommend renewal, recommend transfer, recommend permanent status, recommend non-renewal. There's nothing on the form which indicates that the recommendation made on the particular date of the evaluation is somehow binding on the decision as to whether or not to renew the contract. By statute, the decision to renew the contract is solely within the discretion of the school board. There's nothing that specifically indicates that that discretion has been delegated to anyone. If we flip the scenario around, and the principal at the time of doing the evaluation, either in November, October, or whenever, instead of marking the box about "I recommend renewal," had marked the box "I recommend non-renewal." Would this mean that if the teacher became a stellar teacher, that the principal couldn't change his mind and recommend renewal of his contract? Would this mean that the teacher could not go to the superintendent and ask for a favorable recommendation from the superintendent? Would it mean that he couldn't lobby the school board to get the renewal of his contract? Does it mean that the superintendent and the school board were bound by this non-renewal recommendation of the principal? I don't think anyone would argue that that is the case, and I don't think that the reverse of the argument makes any more sense. As far as mutual explicit understandings, again, we'd remind the court that promises of continued employment by people who have no power to make those promises do not create a property interest. such representations must be consistent with applicable law, which any recommendation in this point would not be, since the power lies with the school board. And the past practice of an employer is not sufficient to establish mutual understandings. The explanation for the superintendent not being aware of anyone else in Mr. Hatfield's circumstance is explained by the fact that everyone else had resigned when approached and informed that they would not be recommended for renewal. The district court also found that even if a property interest existed, there were adequate pre-termination, post-termination procedures in place and followed. Again, Mr. Hatfield met with the superintendent and the principal, and they set forth reasons they were making their recommendation. He had an opportunity to rebut those recommendations, or to rebut those reasons for making their recommendations on April 22nd. He also requested, pursuant to statute, a meeting with the school board, which took place on May 22nd. Lasted an hour and a half. He and his attorney both, after receiving written charges, had the opportunity to state their side of the case to the school board. Some reference has been made to a statement allegedly made by a school board member that this is not a hearing. If the court would look to the context of that statement, which is plaintiff's deposition, page 30, found on page 173 of our appendix. That statement was made in response to Mr. Hatfield's attorney trying to cross-examine people during this meeting with the school board. Both of these meetings took place prior to any deprivation that Mr. Hatfield suffered, which would have been at the supposed beginning of the third contract. And consequently, both constitute pre-deprivation meetings because they address the concern of the Supreme Court that someone is fired and without his paycheck while we're getting around to having a hearing. The district court, I think, adequately addressed the post-termination question. Allegedly, the statement was made by the superintendent that this was only an advisory arbitration and it will come back to the same board that made the initial decision, both of which are statement of facts. We believe that there is no due process claim. The contract claims that Mr. Hatfield makes are basically subsumed in the property interest argument, and unless the court has any questions on that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Semler. Ms. Condras.
With respect to the arguments concerning the property interest that Mr. Hatfield had based upon mutually explicit understandings, the evidence supports a conclusion that Mr. Hatfield's expectation was not subjective. It was based upon the contract itself and also a promise, well, an evaluation made in writing telling him that his contract would be renewed. That was made consistent with the provisions in the contract itself. With respect to this issue about the just cause provision in Article 5, Section D, Section G, there had been a separate clause, Article 2, Section 6, saying that there were additional promises made not required by the statute, and that the fact that they're made in that
again,
contract...
You have a very uphill climb here. It just doesn't make sense for a school to give tenure to someone on his first day, and also, and the way in which the contract distinguishes is between termination and non-renewal. Non-renewal is not termination, it's non-renewal. And your argument makes complete hash of this notion that you progress toward tenure through these two steps. First you're probationary, then you're semi-permanent, then you're permanent. You collapse all that and make it permanent employment from the first day, and that That's it. And then there's makes no sense why they have these three steps.
I see that my time is run.
That's the basic irrationality of your argument.
Thank you, Judge. That just cause provision goes on, though, includes discipline and deprivation of professional advantage. Promises that the school did not have to make under statute, and the school says that it made its decision not to renew the contract based on what it claims are incidents
it
accused against Mr. Hafele.
It could have refused to renew it for any reason.
But thank you.
Not to Judge Postman.
And
no,
again,
that's okay. Forget it. Not necessary.
Judges, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Congress. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.